and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola. Concerts by the CSO on Friday, October 4th through Sunday, the 6th, feature guest conductor Christoph Eschenbach and piano soloist Lucas and Arthur Jussen. The program includes Dreaming by the Fireside from Intermezzo by Richard Strauss, Mozart's Concerto for Two Pianos in E-flat Major, and after intermission, Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, the Pastoral Symphony. Here are Philip Huscher's program notes on the Mozart Concerto for Two Pianos, a work lasting about 26 minutes. The most famous picture of the Mozart family, painted in the winter of 1780 in Salzburg by Johann Nepomuk della Croce, shows Wolfgang and his sister Nannerl seated side by side at the keyboard. Papa Leopold, violin in hand, looks on from the side. His wife, Anna Maria, who died in Paris 2 years earlier, is included in a picture on the wall. The music the Mozart siblings are shown performing is most likely the C major sonata for piano, four hands, that Wolfgang composed at the age of 9, given that his right and her left hands are crossed, as that score demands at one point in the rondo. Music for more than one pianist was rare in Mozart's day, and in fact, Leopold claimed at the time his son wrote his C major sonata that it was the first of its kind. As young children, Wolfgang and Nannerl made a name for themselves playing the piano together when they toured Europe like a family of acrobats in the mid-1760s. Leopold, always the crafty manager, regularly lopped a year off each child's age on posters and theatrical announcements. By the end of the century, music for piano four hands had become a favorite domestic social convention, thrusting good friends, family members, and young lovers into unusually close quarters as they crossed hands, bumped knees, and fought over the middle octave. But music composed for more than one piano has always been a novelty and something of a spectacle designed for public events like this concert. In Mozart's day, homes and even concert halls boasting more than one piano were uncommon. When Mozart moved from Salzburg to Vienna in 1781, he was overjoyed to stay for a while with the Weber family, who placed two pianos at his disposal. Two Weber daughters had already caught his eye. By 1781, Aloysia had rejected Mozart's advances and married Josef Lange, but Costanza would become Mozart's wife within the year. During his first months in Vienna, the land of the clavier, as he called it, Mozart had little income and could not even afford to rent a piano. But by late August or early September, when he moved to his first bachelor quarters, he apparently had scraped together some money, since he commented that he had just enough room for a table, wardrobe, bed, and piano. Around the time Mozart lived, keyboard instruments developed almost beyond recognition, from the harpsichord and clavichord with their gently expressive and discreet tone to the forte piano that foreshadowed the appropriately named grand pianos of our time. During Mozart's 10 years in Vienna, he and Costanza lived in 11 different apartments, and each time they somehow managed to make room for a piano, along with a growing number of growing children and a constant flow of friends, house guests, and pupils. Eventually, Mozart earned enough money to buy his own piano, in addition to a horse and a billiard table, big enough to fill an entire room. When Leopold visited the Mozarts during the spring of 1785, he wrote home to Nannerl, "It is impossible to describe the rush and bustle. Since my arrival, your brother's piano has been taken at least a dozen times to the theater or to some other house." Obviously, Mozart had found a piano he liked and wanted to use it for all his public appearances. Although the music that Mozart wrote for more than one pianist was usually designed for himself and the company of a wealthy patron or a star pupil, it was probably inevitable that he would compose a concerto expressly to perform with his sister. The double concerto in E-flat major, written in the late 1770s, was conceived for the famous sibling act that was now grown up and had long ago stopped going on the road. It is one of his most engaging concertos. Throughout the work, Mozart delights in the almost operatic interplay of the two instruments, not to mention the wondrous racket of racing scales, rumbling Alberti bass lines, and clangorous trills all in duplicate. The piece, however, is no mere stunt. It is a work of maturity, significance, and particularly in the glorious slow movement, truly personal expression. But the sheer joy of sociability, of sharing music and friendship across two keyboards is never absent. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Mozart Concerto for Two Pianos. And now on to Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, the Pastoral Symphony. The work lasts about 40 minutes. Even by 19th century standards, the historic concert on December 22, 1808, was something of an endurance test. That night, Beethoven conducted the premieres of both his fifth and pastoral symphonies, played his fourth piano concerto, conducting from the keyboard, and rounded out the program with the Gloria and the Sanctus from the Mass in C, the concert aria A Perfido, improvisations at the keyboard, and the choral fantasy, written in great haste at the last moment as a grand finale. If concertgoers that evening read their printed program, the luxury of program notes still many decades in the future, they would have found the following brief guide to the Sixth Symphony in Beethoven's own words. Pastoral Symphony, more an expression of feeling than painting. First piece, pleasant feelings which awaken in men on arriving in the countryside. Second piece, scene by the brook. Third piece, merry gathering of country people, interrupted by fourth piece, thunder and storm, into which breaks fifth piece, salutary feelings combined with thanks to the deity. Although Beethoven wasn't by nature a man of words, spelling and punctuation led a perilous existence in his hands, he normally said what he meant. We must then take him at his word, believing that he had good reason, for the only time in his career, to preface his music with a few well-chosen words, and that curious disclaimer, more an expression of feeling than painting. Perhaps Beethoven was anticipating the controversy to follow, because in 1808, symphonies weren't supposed to depict postcard scenes or bad weather. Beethoven's idea itself was neither novel nor his own. In 1784, Beethoven was only 14, an obscure composer named Justin Heinrich Knecht advertised his newest symphonic creation, Le Portrait Musical de la Nature, a musical portrait of nature in five movements, including a depiction of the peaceful countryside, the approach of a storm, and a general thanksgiving to the Creator once the clouds had passed. It would take hearing no more than a measure or two of music to explain why Knecht has remained obscure while Beethoven turned the music world upside down. The descriptive writing and pastoral subject matter of Beethoven's symphony are a throwback to the Baroque era. Think of Vivaldi's The Four Seasons or the pastoral symphony in The Messiah, or at least to Haydn's two oratorios, The Creation and The Seasons, the latter written only a half dozen years earlier. History books are right, of course, to point out the work's novelties, the extra movement, the descriptive titles, the programmatic element, and pictorial details like the bird calls in the slow movement and the village band in the scherzo. But Beethoven was also right in trusting that he who has ever had a notion of country life can imagine without too many descriptive words what the composer has intended. Our familiar picture of Beethoven, cross and deaf, slumped in total absorption over his sketches, doesn't easily allow for Beethoven, the nature lover. But he liked nothing more than a walk in the woods, where he could wander undisturbed, stopping from time to time to scribble a new idea on the folded sheets of music paper he always carried in his pocket. He wrote to Teresa Malfatti 2 years after the premiere of the Pastoral Symphony, "No one can love the country as much as I do, for surely woods, trees, and rocks produce the echo which man desires to hear." They're all here in the Sixth Symphony. The most surprising thing about the opening allegro is how quiet it is. Seldom in 500 measures of music, well over 10 minutes, does Beethoven raise his voice. Surely no composer, including the so-called minimalists, has so clearly understood the impact of repeating a simple idea unaltered or slowing the rate of harmonic change to a standstill. When, near the beginning of the development section, Beethoven changes the harmony only once in the course of 50 measures, the effect of that shift from B-flat to D is breathtaking. Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of this spacious, relaxed, blissfully untroubled movement is that it comes from the same pen that gave us, at the same time no less, that firecracker of a symphony, his fifth, in C minor. Not even Donald Tovey, with his precise use of language, could find a better word to describe Beethoven's slow movement than lazy. We can be sure that laziness is intentional, and it's amazing how much this least restful of composers seems to enjoy the drowsy pace, the endless dawdling over details, the self-indulgent repetitions of favorite sections, and the unchecked meandering through the byways of sonata form. Beethoven begins with a gentle babbling brook, one of those undulating accompaniment figures that Schubert would later do to perfection, and ends with notorious bird calls. The only problem with the birds is that Beethoven calls so much attention to them, bringing the music and the brook to a halt, and then specifying first the nightingale, flute, then the quail, oboe, and finally the cuckoo, clarinet. But as many a writer has pointed out, the birds are no more out of place here than a cadenza in a concerto. The nightingale even provides the final obligatory trill. The third movement is dance music, with a plain, homely, rustic peasant dance for a midsection trio. But the fun is cut short by dark clouds and the prospect of rain. There's probably no more impressive storm in all music. The whole orchestra surges and shakes. Trombones appear for the first time to emphasize the downpour, and the timpani shows up just to add the thunder. This is, of course, no extra movement at all, but merely a lengthy, rapid introduction to the finale. The clouds finally roll away. The oboe promises better things to come in a wonderfully heartfelt phrase. And the flute, with its staccato scale, raises the curtain on Elysium. And so, to the yodeling of the clarinet and horn, we willingly believe F major to be the most beautiful key on earth. The moment is parallel to the great triumphant sunburst that marks the arrival of the finale of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And although the means could hardly be less similar, the effect is just as wondrous. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Beethoven's Symphony No. 6. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.